You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Hi, my name is Angela Fraley. I'm here today talking with Lisa Yoskavich, an artist living and working in New York City. Lisa's represented by David Swerner. Thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
So I wanted to start our conversation by asking about the early days. You know, you have said in previous interviews you come from this working class family. I wanted to kind of talk about that and your education, both undergrad and grad, and leading up to your first show. Well, it's a lot to cram in. And like, yeah.
What would you like to know specifically about it that isn't endlessly talked about? And if it is something that's endlessly talked about, what specifically do you think are you a working class kid?
I am.
Okay, so what do you want to know about? Be as specific as possible, then I can be as specific as possible.
I thought you were being interviewed here.
I'm trying to keep my spot. But
this is kind of an interesting conversation, especially for Yale students, because I knew a lot of kids who are coming from this working class and then are thrust into this environment where you're not swimming in the same schools. So what was that experience like, kind of entering that world? Was your peer group of similar background, or how was that for you?
You know, when my class at Yale was very interesting because we had, I think they did an amazing job with my class because we had older students that were not, you know, like I was basically a squeaky clean, you know, working class doesn't sound squeaky clean, but, you know, as squeaky clean as I could be, you know, my mom had cooked every meal of my life up to the point I got there. You know, I was never lived on my own. I was a commuter in undergraduate school. And when I got there, like actually during my interview, I remember Jesse Murray, who is an artist that I talk about who passed, I was with him when he died of AIDS, which was really one of the most profound experiences of my life, bar none. Mm-hmm. Including something that came out of being at Yale, but he was the first person I saw. We had an interview at the same time, and it was this big black queen, gigantic guy with a giant belly and super gay and waving at me and laughing. And I was with my parents because I, as a total dork, I had my parents drive me in our, like, we had this, our version of a stretch limo. It was like a Volkswagen bus that I sawed the stretcher bars that I had made in the shop at Tyler in half and then folded and got them in the Volkswagen bus to get up to Yale. And we were like the Beverly Hillbillies because I had to sit on a crate in the middle. And I was so excited. And then when I got there, I was like, this guy Jesse was like waving at me and laughing at me because, of course, my dad was trying to help me. And I was like, don't help me, because I was being a brat, like a kid. I was like, don't stop helping me. And of course, this man had been, Jesse was like, I guess I was probably 20, 21, 22, and Jesse was probably 35, mm-hmm. and had been out in the world. He'd been writing, you know, because he was rejected by his family or as a gay man, and had been in this environment intellectually. I don't think it was always so easy for him. Like today, there's such an embrace of the black artist, but I think he also had a hard time finding a place then. Mm-hmm. There was no interest in young artists then, and there was no interest in black artists or any kind of minority artists. I mean, that was the thing, is Whitney biennials were completely loaded with, you know, what we called stars, which we recognize as, you know, almost like our versions of Jack Nicholson, which was awesome and, you know, was aspirational in some way, even though had things stayed like that, a lot of people would never have been in these shows. But Jesse was definitely not someone who survived to benefit from some of the changes that happened in interest in gay artists and all of that. So he was the first person I met. And so, you know, the idea of it being so elite was a little bit changed because the next person I met was this guy named Paul Edwards, who also recently died. He died of cancer recently. And he was a Vietnam vet, and he looked like ZZ Top. I am not lying. And he was they were characters because Paul was from Memphis, and he was a vet, and he sold pot. And when we got there, he was living in a dumpster outside of the school. I'm not kidding. And he asked me on a date, and I was like, oh, please. I cannot date a dumpster diving, pot selling, homeless guy. But actually, part of the some of the work that I made in my last show at Zwirner with the dudes, I was kind of probably channeling Paul a little bit, because there were like one guy had a vet tags, you know, the tags,
right?
What are they called?
Dog tags.
Dog tags on.
Was he a student? Oh, yeah.
He was a student. He was part of our class. Oh, recently I came across, is it okay if I move around while we're doing this? Mm-hmm. I came across a list of our class. Mm-hmm. And this is part of my archive thing that I've been doing lately. Mm-hmm. Check that out. The class is like the class that was ahead of us and my class.
Oh, wow.
And it's pretty wild, right? You could probably scan that and put it on. Do you have like visuals?
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah, yeah. I can send you a
Carl
scan.
Austin,
yeah, this is, well, he was the class ahead of us. You
okay.
see that?
Oh, okay.
Also,
so
interestingly, my side was a much smaller group. I guess they would balance it between larger and smaller groups. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I look at that list, it's like, oh, Anne Agee, you know, she's now a ceramic artist.
Mm-hmm.
She won the prize.
Is it PPW?
Yeah. And she won the prize.
Oh, the Alice Kimball English Traveling.
No, she won the cup. The cup.
Cup.
They don't have the cup anymore?
I don't know. Well, I graduated 10 years ago, so.
Well, the cup. No, I think they still do the cup.
I don't remember.
You probably just spaced it out. But it's the best painting award.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so, yeah, so she took the best painting award and became a ceramic artist.
All done with that, so.
Yeah.
Moving on.
So, you know, and then, you know, down in sculpture you see some other names, but, you know, that doesn't include undergraduate school. Mm-hmm. But it was a pretty interesting, and Anne Hamilton was also an older artist who was in school at the same time. She was very nice. She was in sculpture.
Yeah.
Sculpture. And she was doing her work.
And Jessica Stockholder.
And they were doing their work. Mm-hmm. They were very together. And then there's people there who were also just...
Margaret McCann. She was one of my professors in BU.
Yeah, so, yeah, and she was a class ahead of us.
Okay.
But it's just an interesting... It was like an interesting time, because I think a lot of people were not... It wasn't boring, let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I still felt incredibly inadequate. But I think I went in there looking for a real ass-whooping, because I think I... had in my undergraduate experience, because I was a commuter, I sort of felt a little sorry for myself, because, you know, we didn't have enough money to afford the dorms.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, I had my little Volkswagen and drove to school and strapped my paintings to my Volkswagen and drove my big paintings to school and worked in my bedroom. I, you know, worked at my parents' house in a neighborhood called Juniata Park. And it's interesting because you can actually Google Earth it. And it's like, I think a Korean family bought it. It's kind of amazing. Like they have a garden in the front yard where they're growing vegetables. It's like, it's just like moved along, but a lot of artists are actually living there. Like Alex DeCorta lives in Juniata Park. It freaked me. Can I say the fuck out?
Yeah.
It freaked me the fuck out. Like I was like, kind of like, okay, I can't talk to you right now. I'm like actually like too much to think about that the neighborhood I grew up in is becoming a artist habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And I unfortunately could never deal with going back there, because it would bring me back to something that, like the neighborhood I'm in now, the Gowanus, when I first got off the subway to come here to see the studio, it reminded me so much of where I came from, because it's like industry and little salt bucks, you know, little houses and kind of like you feel the exact same vibe, a kind of salt of the earth people.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, yeah. So I kind of had when I got to Yale, I really deeply, deeply felt an incredible bottoming out of my sense of whether or not painting was something that I had the right to do. And I think that...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I do think that they probably... I came in there doing rather bravura work. And I do think that there is something really twisted about that place, especially back then, where it's all about like let's kick the ass of the kid that's actually good. See what the hell, you know, it's like the boot camp mentality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I think I never really wanted to teach after that, because it's like being an abused child. You probably tend to grow up and be an abuser unless you're careful.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to teach, because in a way, like I taught a long time to make money because I had to. And I did not really want to get, you know, I was kind of like undergraduate, and I was really tried to be very careful and not you know, about like, who the hell do you think you are trying to be an artist? Don't you know a great artist? And I really, you know, I've done a number of teaching gigs with some of the Yale people, like, you know, and I am so down on the way. I mean, if you, I've noticed it, like if students show real potential, there's a way in which they're kind of get the legs kicked out from under them mm-hmm. just for shits and giggles. I mm-hmm. sometimes think it's just, you know, it's the presumption is that they're being taught, but what are they being taught? They're being taught how fucking mean the world is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. and I just didn't want to really have a part of that. Mm-hmm. And I was so naive that I took it very seriously. A guy named Jim Cambrone, who was in the class ahead of us, and he teaches at not BU, but at Mass Art. He ended up on the faculty because he was, you know, a year ahead, right. And he ended up being hired. And he told me that we're very close friends. He actually came to my opening at the Rose and the dinner and everything because he lives up there. And he said, you know, you were the first choice. You were like, because we were on the jury, like you were the one that was like number one. So the fact is that I think that I was actually just really
the first choice for what?
To get in. Like there was he said there was no question I was going to get in. Like, oh, this, she's good. Okay. In.
Right.
And then I got there and it was like, how did you get in the school? Like, who do you think you are? Like, why do you think you get to paint these paintings? And the thing is that I caved in. This is my bad. I caved in immediately. Mm-hmm. So it's really much less the working class thing. I mean, yeah, that played a role. I think that I was young. Mm-hmm. I think that I...
Did you go straight from undergrad?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that I felt... I went from my parents' house to there. I think... And my undergraduate school is very dear to me and Tyler, and they gave me so much warmth and still do. Mm-hmm. And actually, even after I got out of Yale, I found out many times over that the faculty were on juries. The thing is that you have to watch out. If you're on a jury and you trash somebody, people on juries will tell that person. And I wish that they wouldn't. You always have to wonder the motivation of the person that comes running to you to tell you about that.
Right.
Because, you know, then I have to walk around knowing it, and I wish I didn't know it, but I don't even apply for things anymore because I'm like afraid of that story. I mean, you know, nobody's going to give me a grant now, but you know, it's like, I heard minute to minute stories and they were like faculty who said she's not serious. And the thing is, it's so offensive because it's like literally again, years later, kick the legs out from mm-hmm. under this chair. I mean, what are you, jealous of me? I mean, seriously, like, what's the story? I was not the kind of female student that they wanted to fuck. So therefore, the fact that I actually was maybe gifted, they wanted to fucking knock me down. I don't get that. But I didn't let it really ultimately take me. Basically, I don't think about this stuff on a daily basis. Right. We're talking about it. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that the question is it possible sometimes for people to envy you as a faculty? And it is possible. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that was what was going on.
Right.
And in some cases, I heard some extremely amazing things that I still use to this day.
Like what?
Mel came into my studio once, and when I was doing something good, finally, interesting. Yeah. Well, he's a critic, and he basically showed me something really important, which was, when I was painting, he says, okay, you're a figurative painter. This is where you're illustrating. And this is where you have art ideas.
Mm. Where were those? What pockets of the...
Well, they're, you know, art ideas are like, you know, when a painting is showing and not telling. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, it's how the abstraction and the pictorial nature of the work actually creates a message to the viewer. Mm-hmm. The meaning is brought through. And that was very important. Mm-hmm. And that, and I often look at figurative painting and feel like there, you know, people could be highly, highly skilled in their ability to make pictures and make space. But I don't see that, mm-hmm. what Mel was talking about. That's a harder thing.
Mm-hmm. How do you know when you've done that now?
Well, it's interesting because when I look at my looking at this catalog thing that I've been doing in this website, looking through my work, because I now have a unique ability to do that. You know, in the past with slides, it was clumsy, and now you kind of I can flip through. I mean, I can see which ones really did that super powerfully, like where, you know, like I followed through on a very strict set of order, like order in a painting. Another thing I learned really well,
like spatial order, or
it can be any kind of order, color order, spatial order, light order. The things that
when you were setting up those intentions before beginning the paintings, or you were working those ideas out throughout. Were you taking cues from the painting itself, or were you
in some cases any of the above? Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes. I mean, you know, when you're working, I started to do some smaller paintings in order to work out a lot of those cues intuitively, because when you get to a larger painting, you know, I don't like to slop around. I mean, there's a lot of slopping around, but it's a different kind. So it's really, but like also just to go back to like, you know, one thing is like I studied with Bailey and his incredible, he's like a brilliant man, you know, like that was the thing is these people are really brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And really was really very influential about sort of creating the sense of air, like the idea that there is air in a possible sense of air and weather in a painting.
Mm.
So that was really important. Andrew Forge was also very important. I'm somebody who died, I think, before you guys had an opportunity to meet him. Andrew Forge really taught us to look at paintings, and he was very loving. He was also an art historian. He wrote a book on Monet and Degas, and he was a real lover. And I took Bernie Chait's life drawing class, and really, you know, that was fascinating. I got along with Bernie really well. A lot of people didn't, because I actually just constantly made fun of him. And he sort of enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I used to do Dr. Ruth Westheimer imitations and say, Bernie, do you masturbate? And he would, well, and he would just laugh. Yeah. He would just laugh. He just like, I guess like I knew who not to say it to,
right.
You know, I would say that to some of them. But like ultimately, you know, we really ultimately taught each other a lot. I mean, my mm-hmm. ultimate teacher at Yale were my peers.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was a student at Yale, and we're still talking about painting every day, mm-hmm. all the time. Like, lying in bed last night, I took an iPhone picture of the painting in the studio and showed it to him. And, you know, he's like, well, I really think that you should, you know, like, and this would be, and I said, well, that really is wrong. I don't think so. And, you know, but it's like a constant conversation. And I'm still very close to John Curran, and his wife and kids are, you know, like family.
Mm-hmm.
People think we should be at each other at all times. And that could have been very easily done,
uh-huh.
but
why would people think you should be at each other?
Oh no, because we're supposed to be competing.
Oh, okay.
And and the thing is that we were too smart for that. You know, we knew that. Well, John says if I'm not friends with you guys, who am I going to be friends with? but because like we speak a very particular language. You know, mm-hmm. it's like we did go to boot camp together,
mm-hmm.
and we do understand. It's like we don't talk about Yale that much. I mean, I did fax that and send that to John and had a good laugh. And we were like going, oh, I wonder if that person's still alive. You know, because at this point, it's like a lot of these people have passed away, you know, and it's sort of weird. And you're like, remember that guy? Was he the big guy? Was he that guy with the bad shoes? Or, you know, and like you just remember these kind of like vague people.
Mm-hmm.
And you always wonder, like, are they like still artists? Do they? And then John told me about one of the people on that list. Actually, just the other night, he said, oh, that woman trashed me on a, you know, on a thing somewhere. And I said, no. And he said, yeah. And he takes out his phone. He shows it to me. And I was like, that's really uncool of her. Really uncool of her, because she should be celebrating you. It was some feminist thing. And it's so lame to go after that with him, because he's actually like, I mean, I'm not going to argue him whether he's a feminist or not. I mean, I always just say, oh, you know, I think most people are just assholes, or, you know, whether they're like misogynists, they're just assholes generally. But I just think like, it's not like it was an ungenerous thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really don't believe in trashing other artists,
mm-hmm.
Generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not something, I don't know what an artist would have to do for me to want to really pick on them. But I really do feel that artists, starting from the time when I got to undergraduate school, and definitely most intensely when I got to Yale, that I found my, you know, it's like a community. And because I, you know, most, like most of us, we feel really lonely as kids because we're aliens and we're from nowhere. I mean, I guess this goes back to the working class thing, but I think even rich kids feel alienated who, I don't think it's about rich or poor. And I just think in some ways, you know, I just didn't have art lessons until later and had a lot of catching up to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas some other kids actually maybe had gone to the Governor's School or Cooper Union. And like, I didn't have my shit together, didn't have good enough guidance to get into Cooper Union or to know what that was like. But I really believe that, and I'm not a Buddhist, and I'm not, I know I sound kind of like a space cadet, but I say stuff like this, but I do feel like if you truly believe you're being taken care of, you are. Mm-hmm. And I feel like even sometimes the things you don't get are gifts, mm-hmm. and you have to find a way to make them into gifts. That's mm-hmm. as Pollyanna as it gets. But I have had the chance of looking back and seeing that be true. Mm-hmm. Does that make you happy to hear that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's things that are, you're like, all those things I didn't get,
right.
I'm now going to think, just wait. But it's not just that. I mean, it's also how life is not about your luck, about, you know, I mean, obviously luck is a big piece of it. Like, you're lucky if you're born, you know, with your hands, then you get to make art. But, you know, we've seen Chuck Close's hand stopped working 20 years ago and he still kept making art. I mean, there's ways to always find your way around things. But I do think that, you know, in that sense, everybody can come out of the gate. This is one thing about Yale. You know, you get into Yale and you're like, I am obviously so good. I'm better than everybody. And things are going to go great because I already have exceeded expectation.
Right.
And then you get dropped out and then you find out what a joke that is.
Right.
And then you are, you know, reeling for years because also I remember getting out of Yale and trying to get a job just to patch together some money that was because like my student loan money was dwindling or whatever was left over was clearly I could see the lack of light at the end of the tunnel. And I was like, what am I? So I was like trying to get a job doing like steno work. And, you know, I remember the dude saying, let me get this straight. You went to Yale and you want to work for us. I mean, it was like you learn not to say you went to Yale.
Right.
Because it's like could have make everybody laugh at you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to know when to pull it out and when not to pull it out. And like ultimately I got a job right out of Yale in Hoboken. And this is ridiculous, but it was the only job I could get. And I was grateful to get it because I needed to paint and I wasn't able to make money off of painting. I got a job lifeguarding at the YMCA in Hoboken.
Uh-huh.
And we lived in Hoboken. John and Matthew and I all shared a loft. They went off to Manhattan and did construction work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, like, I've read things about myself where I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I was like, I wish. I mean, somehow I think I've gotten conflated with my art dealers or something. You know, like, I'm like, but, you know, on the other hand, the fact that I had all that scrappy shit happen to me and I came out looking like I had a silver spoon in my mouth kind of pleases me because I'm like, what would it be better if I came out with like band-aids all over me and like wounded? You know, it's good to kind of like seem sturdy, I guess, you know, like, but anyway, so
how long were you doing that?
I did that for a lot long, like, so like 6-4 years.
Oh wow.
It was okay. Like I couldn't get
was
out.
It was like a 40-hour work week kind of.
Well, what happened is because I'm so tenacious, tenacity has always been, like people say, like, you know, like if I'm talented, one of my talents is tenacity. And I was like, I became friendly with, this goes to like when to pull the Yale card. I, you know, when you begin to sense that people are into it, that's when you pull it.
Mm-hmm.
But don't pull it in advance of that because it will go off, you know, friendly fire and you'll shoot yourself in the foot. But some guy that was running the Y, he had a kid that I guess he had some aspirations, like, ooh, she went to Yale so she could write him a letter. You know, the kid was like 4.
Right.
And I kind of caught wind of that he was thinking he could, you know, use me somehow. And I ended up figuring out a way to get myself to be the pool supervisor. And then I didn't have to work as many hours. I got paid not to work.
Okay.
But the problem was if a lifeguard didn't show up,
oh,
I had to just drop everything and show up. And that happened all the time. But I get paid for my not showing up on top of the hours for lifeguarding. And I read a lot of books, even though you're not supposed to read when you lifeguard. But, and I saw a lot of people who later I met in the art world swimming, and I would like recognize them. I'd say, oh yeah, you pulled too hard with your right arm. Because I'm just like, you see people like swimming day after day after day, like, you know, lap after lap. And it was insanely boring. But I remember reading Down and Out in Paris and London, kind of, and I remember reading the Painted Bird, you know, all these sort of tales of woe. I was kind of relating to, you know, or all of Orwell, you know, I read all of Orwell like, while sitting. And so it was a beautiful swimming pool. It was actually not the worst of all places, but I ended up then figuring out how to, I was also had a water safety instructor certificate along with my Yale MFA. Mm-hmm. And I took that and created a swimming program because this guy was still trying to get me to write a letter for his son.
Right.
To go to Yale.
You really strung him
and
along
so
for
he,
a while.
Yeah, I did. And no, it was him. He really was like very impressed that I went to Yale. I was like, all right, we got a live one on the hook. And then I turned myself into a swimming instructor and was able to pay myself like $50 an hour. And at like the end of the year, the people who were doing the books at the Y realized I was making more money than the guy who hired me because I was like relentless about my motto as a young artist was fewer hours, higher pay.
Yeah.
Fewer hours, higher pay. How do I get paid more per hour? I also had a lifeguarding job. I also had a bartending job in Hoboken, and it was at a place called Riley's Pipe Dreams, and I got arrested for serving a minor, and I'm looking for my arrest certificate. I'm sure it's in the state of New Jersey's database, but I had something which I'm looking to put on my wall here, that, and it actually said the state of New Jersey versus Lucius Gavin. And I, you know, I was like really put through the ringer. I was in like a holding cell. I mean, it was a whole thing. It was like they actually were typing. It was like, and you're too young to remember the show, but I guess maybe Nickelodeon, you maybe could watch reruns of it. It was called Barney Miller or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like this old creaky, it was basically like the police station actually the way they were, where it was just sort of like all like
right.
people drinking coffee
piles
and it was like
of
piles of paper
yeah.
and like some grumpy people typing badly. So this guy was trying to type this scavenge on a manual typewriter and kept making mistakes. And like, I'm sitting there with like my, cause I was wearing some sexy clothes so I could make good tips.
Uh-huh.
And I was like sitting there and he kept putting white out over my name. It was getting really chunky cause he kept misspelling my name. And so I piped in and said, would you like me to type that for you? It might go faster. And he would like, he handcuffed me. He handcuffed me. And I was like, oh my God. Okay, whatever you do, don't say Yale. You'll end up getting like gang raped here. It's like, it was like, Hoboken is a dangerous place for an artist, I realized. So that's when we left and came to Manhattan.
Okay.
And slowly but surely started getting teaching jobs.
Okay, in, where were you teaching?
I ended up teaching watercolor at Cooper Union Continuing Ed.
Okay.
And taught like older people, people like my age now, who I thought of as old ladies. people after work who had aspired to be artists but never got to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was very touching. I mean, it was not...
They're the best people to teach.
They were amazing.
Yeah.
They were amazing. And I had profound, profound life experiences with these people. One guy was taking my watercolor one, watercolor two, and watercolor three class all at the same time. And I said, I remember him so, I can see him so clearly. His name was Walter. And he had very thick, gray, wavy hair. He had like that incredible Italian man hair. And he, so elegant. And he said, I said, Walter, why don't you save your money and, you know, take one after another? And he said, no, he goes, I've been looking for something like this all my life. I was a graphic designer. I've struck gold here. I just want to take your class all the time. I will just want to talk to you all the time. And I was like, okay, whatever. And I was probably like 28,
mm-hmm.
30.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably like 70 something,
mm-hmm.
and was the cheeriest guy, super good looking. And then he asked me to come to his apartment to see his other paintings. And I thought, uh-oh.
Here we go.
Here we go. I'm going to get molested. And then I was like, thank God I went, and he told me, I'll pay you $100, which of course, you know, well, I guess it's worth being molested for $100. I can always run.
Okay.
Well, he hadn't offered me anything
right.
but to look at his paintings. So I went to his apartment, and it was this amazing address. It was like 12th Street and 6th Avenue, right? Like this beautiful brownstone. And I went in, and it truly was filled with paintings. And he was like on fire. And then I stopped coming to class. And he gave me $100. And he was so sweet. And, you know, and I took the $100 because I really needed it. And I left. And I never saw him again. And then I got a letter in the mail. And I remember I used to collect my mail leaving our apartment. We lived at 151 Ludlow Street. It was like the most hideous apartment in the world. Probably is still as hideous and probably costs like 10 grand to live there now. But it was this railroad apartment. It was like the toilet was in the bath, was in the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
You could hear people go to the bathroom in the kitchen. And the bedroom was right off of that. And my studio was right next to that. It was just like, I said, I grew up poor, but we were not dirty. So Mathe loved it because he thought it was bohemian. Because he grew up in Russia, so there was no such thing as poor. Uh-huh. You know, everybody was equal.
Right.
So, you know, except for the, you know, upper Soviets. But anyway, so I collected my mail, and I go, and I've always had this thought, and I'm sure your listeners who are young artists totally know what I'm talking about. I kept thinking there may be one day a letter in the mail that said that I won some grant.
Yeah. The only reason to check your mail. Yeah.
Right, because they were always like bills
right.
that I couldn't pay or right. like letters from somebody who was saying that I was doing something wrong or in my case, an arrest warrant. And so I opened the letter and I was always so excited. So I was leaving the house and I'm walking up Ludlow Street and I opened this letter. I was like, maybe it's a check. And
it's I opened
the letter, and by the time I got to Katz's Deli, it was the top of the street, and this was before cell phones, it was a letter from a man who said that he was settling the estate of this Walter, and mm-hmm. in there was a letter to me, and he died
mm-hmm.
shortly after. He had like some terminal cancer. He did not take any drugs for it. That's why he looked so good. And he wrote me a letter telling me that it was like the most important thing that happened in his life. I mean, to have met someone, you know, because being a Yale student, you're way overqualified to be teaching these classes. But, you know, because you're, I mean, I taught them like as if they were college level classes because
right.
I didn't know how to dumb it down.
Yeah.
And I was teaching, you know, about, you know, contrast and, you know, ideas about how contrast can like mean all the stuff in the world. And he's eating it up. And like I said, he was on fire. He just painted his little heart out and then just passed away. And I was a mess on the corner of Ludlow and Houston. I got to the payphone and called Mathe and was like crying and reading this letter and just saying, oh my God, look, I had no idea. This is what we could do with these. You know, you just think I'm just going to make some money here. You know, I'm going to just like teach
right.
these classes. But those people were profound. And I had a woman named Gertrude who was like so intense. And when Mathe and I got married, all my students took my class over and over and over and over again, many of them. And they all chipped in and got us a room at the Royalton Hotel because we lived in such a dump.
Uh-huh.
they knew it so that we would have a nice room
Aww.
On our wedding night.
Aww.
And it was just so touching. I mean, I was blubbering half the time around
right.
these people. And once in a while, they show up at my openings, the ones that are still alive.
Mm.
And it's very touching. They're like, we're so proud of you.
Oh.
We knew you were going to make it. You know? It was so sweet. It's very sweet,
yeah.
you know. And that's the thing is that you just, you know, like one way or another, like I didn't think back to the thing, like, you know, poor me. I'm a poor kid. My parents can't support me. I have to have a job. But I had these incredible experiences that really, you know, deepened my empathy,
mm-hmm.
which is an invaluable experience mm-hmm. as an artist. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what I could do with the Walter piece, but I feel like, you know, it makes you a better person to have known these people.
Mm-hmm.
And how would I know those people if I had been like Grant Girl 101, you know, and had only been hanging around with Guggenheim fellows and at the Radcliffe and at this thing and at that thing. And, because I was unlucky. I was kind of lucky in mm-hmm. a certain way. Mm-hmm. But I think what I was trying to say before is that, you know, if we tend to want to believe, you know, like, you blast out and you're super successful and you're starting off great. And those of us who went to Yale kind of have that experience, or in any graduate school, you know, you get in and it's like, oh, it's all good. It's all exciting. And let's say you get out and you're like kind of, you get your first show and it's like amazing. People really, and then they drop you.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah. Then what?
Well, first you cry. As they say. You know, then what makes you is how you rebound from that. Mm-hmm. It's always about how you have to build your rebounding skills mm-hmm. as an artist. That I've given two commencement addresses. One was at Yale.
When was that?
Yeah, exactly. When was that? Actually, Alex DeCorda, not to bring him up too many times in this. Like, I met him because he came up to me like a year or two later. He was at David Zwirner's house for something. He was friends with his daughter, and he came up to me and he said, I was graduating. So whatever year he graduated was that year. And it was the year of the economic crisis. So, and something like that. Yeah, and I was the first commencement speaker. Rob decided to have a commencement speaker to just the art school. And I said, and then my undergraduate one, there were variations on a similar theme, which was basically the role of uncertainty in the life of an artist mm-hmm. and how uncertainty is the only thing you can be certain of. Mm-hmm. And that in reality, you know, when we see things like the world coming crashing down around us with economic, you see what jackasses bankers are. You know, mm-hmm. they get to wear suits and seem important, but they're worse than us. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that like quit or commit suicide when like something is just a little bit wrong. You know what I mean? Like they can't cope mm-hmm. because life was, I went to this, and then I went to that school, and then I got a job, and then I got my car, and then I got my wife and my three kids, and I did this and I did that. And it's like, that's just not the way it is, because ultimately you have to deal with the death of parents, the death of friends, the, you know, setbacks. And it's about, you know, I won't say, like, one of the things Jesse said to me when I first was at Yale, and this is the older guy who I was with when he passed away. When I was at Yale, I remember he said, this is before he knew he was HIV positive. He wasn't even talking about himself. He just said, because he was older than me, and I got really depressed. I actually took advantage of the Yale Mental Hygiene Clinic quite a bit. And mm-hmm. I remember I went in for crisis counseling because I was so depressed I couldn't get out of bed. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid to make the paintings I came in with because I felt so highly criticized for those paintings that basically, it was suggested that I paint still lives, and I made the saddest fucking still life paintings in the world, and then got more depressed about it. And so I remember the crisis shrink. She was great. She said, let me get this straight. After I had drowned her in tears, like, she's like, how are you? I was like, ah! And then she said, okay, in summation, you need to see yourself in your work. But when you put yourself in your work, you personally feel criticized. So you've taken yourself out of your work. So what you need to do is put yourself back in your work, but in a way that is really true to where you're at now. And I have a feeling if you do that, you will find yourself not quite so criticized. So I thought about that, and I thought, well, that's pretty smart. Very rational. Uh-huh. And being rational sort of helps you get yourself out of these type of thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, of like tailspins. So I decided to paint myself in bed. And I made these actually quite wonderful paintings of myself, not myself, a figure, you can't tell it's me, mm-hmm. sort of lying under the covers, and it looks like they're like under a, I can very easily, it's actually, when you Google, you can go on the website, you can actually look, it'll probably say sleeper or sleeping or yellow sleeper, and it'll go away, you know, because you can search by title. Mm-hmm. There's one I can't find an image of, and it was actually my favorite one, and I know it's here somewhere and I'm going to find it, but it's like this other one is pink, and it looked like I was, or the figure rather, is under a field, like almost under a hoed field, like almost like a death image. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depression is a little mini death. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, I think that I kind of took that real sadness. And the thing that Jesse told me when that happened, he said, oh, you're really lucky. And I said, excuse me, how am I lucky? And he said, no, you're lucky to have this happen now because you have all the support. And he said, and it'll happen again. I was like, oh my God, please don't say that. He said, no, because people who feel deeply, mm-hmm. that's what happens to them, that they have the blues, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, he's like, you know, you're not depressed. You're not like hospitalized. You're not like in a straitjacket, you know, you're mm-hmm. not, you're able to fight your way out of this, but you understand, you know, you have to understand darkness to really be able to communicate to people. You have to know what sadness is. Otherwise, how will you communicate to people? Mm-hmm. You have to know a range of emotions to communicate to people. And then when he found out at Yale at the pretty similar location that he was HIV positive, he asked me if I would be there with him through that journey. And I had no idea what I was getting myself in for. But even that experience, you know, I remember when I had my first show, as he was going through being ill and trying to paint the whole time. And it's funny because even the fact that I have this archive now, when he was dying, I went to this, AIDS was everywhere. And it seemed like everyone important was dying. They had this seminar, which I took for how to preserve an estate of an artist with their work. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Because artists are, when artists die, they are wealthy people who die with no money. Mm-hmm. They're rich because of their estate, but they have no money. So like, how do you preserve an estate like that? How do you protect people's work? So mm-hmm. I tried to do that and I got all excited and I took all the stuff to him and he got mad at me and threw me out of his room and said, you know, he didn't want to deal with it. And so I ended up after he died having all this crap for like putting your slides and then marking the name and giving it a code. And because I happened to buy it for him, I just used it myself. And weirdly that has come in handy now because I have all that early work because I was just like, I had nothing better to do with it. I bought all the materials and he didn't want it. So I started coding my own work and creating it.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, and they're all in those black boxes down there. Those are like all in the black boxes down there. Those are all like the things that I bought for him. This is pre-digital stuff. Anyway, his work is not archived and nothing has been able to be done with it, but that was his choice. He chose that. Mm-hmm. And, I felt sorry about that, but I had to back off. But mm-hmm. when he was in the hospital and I had my first show at Elizabeth Cory Gallery, I remember I made the mistake of thinking he was like, wanted to know all about the opening and he was really, really ill. And I remember he had an oxygen mask on and I called him and he said, you know, who was there? Who was at the opening? And he was asking for people's names. He kind of wanted to like experience it. And then the next time I saw him, I was like still bubbling because mm-hmm. I was so excited. I had my, like this show and it was like people, like artists really liked it. Like Chuck Close came to see it and like Laurie Simmons came to see it and Cindy Sherman came to see it and I was bubbling. And, uh-huh. and he said, people are fucking dying here. Can't you see, you self-centered bitch? And I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to get this right. And then he, you know, once he got that off his chest, he said, you know, Lisa, I just want you to know something. Don't be so excited about all this because you were great before they said you were great. Mm-hmm. You're happy because somebody's legitimizing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But I want you to know when they abandon you and they will abandon you. And once again, I'm like, what are you saying this for? Why are you saying this? Like, you know, every these bad things are going to happen to you again. But he said, and when they abandon you, I don't want you to think that you're not great. Mm-hmm. I want you to believe in yourself because it has nothing to do with them. So he was like so profoundly an important wow. aspect of how I was able to form. And so when this person abandoned me, who I was all excited about and wouldn't pay me. And like a child whose parents get divorced, I thought it was because my work wasn't good enough. And then Jesse had already died and I was able to stop and remember what he said and hang on to it and say, no, it's not me. Mm-hmm. It's you. Mm-hmm. And it's not the work. Mm-hmm. And hang on to that and try to like not get swallowed up. And I often call this long phase of my life circling the drain, because it's like some sort of booger. I was floating around, and it was like going around and around and around and around, and I kept feeling the pull down. And there's really no safety net, but you know, because there's no safety net for any artist, there's no guarantee for any artist, like, you know, will we be important in the long run? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Will we have anybody even like what we do? Will we be able to keep a gallery? Will we be able to whatever? What will happen next year? You don't know. So that this idea of uncertainty is really the important thing to basically just build your reality around, mm-hmm. and not in a negative way. Mm-hmm. To just to support all of that. And then also uncertainty is like really important in delving into, I think, also looking at work and to be curious. Like, I'm a viewer of other people's work, and I like to not be sure. Like, I like to see things that I'm not sure are good, mm-hmm. and then be transformed into it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's enough looking at art like that. I feel like one of the things that bugs me a lot about the art world is I feel like, and I think that professionals suffer from this as well as other artists, and I mean, forget about, like, you know, the moms and pops that are coming in that want to see nice pictures. But I think that so many people go to see art looking to be, to have check boxes, mm. and like go, yummy, that filled that yummy, you know, like, I wanted a hamburger today and that was a delicious hamburger. Uh-huh. Like, what, you know, what if you don't, you know, it's like the metaphor being like, you know, you don't eat meat, mm-hmm. and somehow you ended up gobbling down a hamburger, right. and you're like, shit, that changed me. That experience changed me. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's this catalog that I'm not sure the gallery gave you, mm-hmm. the one from the most recent show. Mm-hmm. In that interview I did with Katie Siegel, that I was mentioning, I was driving one day and I was listening to like Lenny Lopate or something, was interviewing this woman named Isabel Wilkerson, and I never heard of confirmation bias. And she talks about confirmation bias, and of course she's talking about it more in regards to racism and things. But I think that there's a form of racism, I don't mean as race, but like prejudice in general towards looking and not literally not being open, coming with preconceived ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think that what Isabel Wilkerson was saying is like about racism and other things is like you see a person, you come with a predetermined set of ideas about that person because of their skin color, because of their size, you know, they're fat. That must mean they stay up all night and eat ice cream, mm-hmm. you know, and ugly thoughts that, you know, may or may not be true, but the problem is that it limits your ability to experience something. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to art, you know, I would like to be the kind of viewer, and I try to be the kind of viewer, and I also want to be the kind of artist that asks people to partake in something they may not necessarily want to partake in. Mm-hmm. And I want to not, and I find it become, that like it's part of my mission for myself as a person is to try to confront my own biases and to confront them, mm-hmm. and to, especially with art, mm-hmm. and not categorically say, well, I don't like anything like that, mm-hmm. you know, and to be as open as possible. Cause I do think that in the end, that is where uncertainty can feed back into art and why we're given as artists, particularly uncertain lives, because it's like the macro and the micro there. I think that our really uncertain lives should really be reflected in the real uncertainty of our work. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that there is, you cannot make an object that you're certain that anybody's going to want.
Right.
You're going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
Because they might want it today and they won't want it tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You has to be something that's like, gives you like it's almost like mouth to mouth resuscitation. It brings you to life every time you do it. Like, I actually really feel like myself when I paint. Mm-hmm. I feel like I know everything. Like, I'm connected to every thought. I can remember every move I've ever made in a painting when I'm painting. Mm-hmm. Every painting I've ever made, I'm connected to it. You know, I have to live a lifestyle. I can't be like drunk and high. And, right. You know, like, I mean, granted, like, I could probably chip away at that memory, but it's like, it's really important to me to be able to access, you know, everything I've ever done so that then I can sort of push forward and try to sort of experience new things and bring new things in. Mm-hmm. you know, in ways that are interesting and exciting and a little daunting to me, you know, like that painting I just showed you. I mean, I kind of think it looks, you know, kind of amazing. And I'm also kind of afraid that it's totally retarded. You know, it's like what's a ridiculous painting?
Yeah.
And Matt Fay, who has been looking at my paintings with me since we first met, I guess that, you know, he got into Yale at 1985. So since then, and he's, wow. That's a long time.
Yeah.
And he says, you always say that. Yeah. So it's great to have friends around you. Mm-hmm. Do you keep friends from?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Like your so what part of what I've said is, you know,
well, that's confirmation. It's really interesting to hear that the, in studio practice, that feeling of like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever made, but it also might be the best.
Well, that, but that's the thing is tension. How could you, like, okay. It's really key, both as a viewer of another person's art and your own art. If it looks like something that you've seen, mm-hmm. then why would you make it?
Mm-hmm.
It has to kind of, maybe it can have some aspects that are familiar,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of like...
Then it's just execution.
It's very strange to me how much... You know, well, it was weird. It was like going through the, I think one of the best shows I've seen in my life was that de Kooning show, whatever, a year or two ago at MoMA. It was just, wow, that was an amazing show. And the guy was a great artist every step of the way, you know, like every single body of work. And they had that, the way the show was set up, like every body of work had a room.
Mm-hmm.
And you could like really, like you realize there are other careers, like at least 10 other careers of famous artists, legitimate famous artists who are based on that one moment in
mm-hmm.
his work.
Mm-hmm.
Like he broke ground and moved on.
Mm-hmm.
And then people just was like just feeding off of it.
Right.
and it's like, he was like moving along and he just kept on going and just would like drop this idea or develop it to something else. And you can love or hate different aspects of his work, but it was always, you know, thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you look at those bodies of work and you're like, I can literally, because there wasn't enough of his work.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's sort of like, it's really worth thinking, how can I be wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Like, let yourself be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have been wrong and I've been told I'm wrong, which makes me think I'm right. I just tell you like that for logic.
Well, how have you kind of ridden the ride of some of those reviews that you had early on in your career?
How did I ride the ride?
Yeah.
How did I get rid of it?
Well, it seemed like...
Did you read them all?
I did not read them all, but I've
there's so many of them.
You know,
there's so many of them.
Yeah. So,
well, you want to, like, the more like, how did I get over recent ones, or...
Well,
like...
you kind of talked about it a little bit earlier when you were discussing, you know, the... when they abandon you, or, you know, you're looking for legitimization outside of yourself or something, and you know that you need to kind of stay true to you and all of those things that you were talking about with your friend. But yeah, there were some, I've seen some really intense quotes for reviews in
like,
the early
like,
days.
You remember any of them?
Well, like Lane Roulette.
Yeah, that's a famous one.
Yeah. What are some others that, I mean, have you been shaken?
Well, just in case people don't know what he said, why don't you tell them?
Why don't you tell them? Because
I heard you
memorize them.
What, because of the Catherine Lord thing?
Yeah.
She said that I liked them so much I could lick them.
Yeah.
I didn't say that. That essay is actually very funny.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that essay funny?
I did find
I think
it.
It's, yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
A lot of people didn't think it was funny, but once you read it as funny, it's actually funny. It actually is very funny. What it was is, I remember it came through a fax machine, and prior to that...
Wait, how did it come through?
Because
it was
a show in LA, and first of all, I really loved that work, and I knew that work was really good.
Uh-huh.
A lot of that work is in the Rose show.
Uh-huh.
And when is this going on air? Like,
we'll do it soon.
In 2 minutes?
Yeah.
So I would really love people to go see the show.
Okay.
Can we just like do a plug?
Yeah.
A commercial aside? I mean, because
when
I
does
don't
that show
have
come down?
The middle, it's middle of like, let's say December 13th or
okay.
something.
So we still have a few months.
Yeah, a few months. And it's really, there's a lot going on in Boston, so you don't have to just do my show. There's a great show at the MFA like a Rembrandt show or something like that, other things going on. But it's a really rare opportunity to see work of mine from 25 years ago. I mean, there are these Bad Baby paintings from the Liz Corey show and, you know, all kinds of things. And, you know, you can print out reviews from that time and look at those paintings and say, oh, that's what they hated. But the thing about that review is, and I'm sure the man regrets having written it because I've had such a good time with it, is I thought it was positive. And my husband said, Lise, it's not positive. This is negative. And I was like, but it's so smart. And it understands what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So it basically, I coined the phrase, which I'm not coining because it already exists, which is, you say that like, the quote is, somebody will say, you know, your paintings are like visual stink bombs. Intended, I don't have it memorized, but okay, let's say her paintings are like visual stink bombs launched for the sole purpose of seeing the fur fly or something like that, you know, something like that. Better than that. Something like giving any credibility to this work would be like reining in an outlaw by deputizing them. That's awesome. Like, like, I don't mean to be well-behaved. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Like, he got it. Mm-hmm. He didn't like it. But that doesn't mean it's a bad review.
Right.
What I like is a smart person getting it.
Uh-huh.
I want communication. You know, like that Jodie Foster movie where she's out in outer space? Like, what's it called? The Contact?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, when you're an artist and you're alone in your studio and then you show and nobody gives a shit mm-hmm. for years and then suddenly you make contact.
Uh-huh.
Even if that alien hates you, it's fucking contact. It's amazing. You know, it's like, wow, somebody heard me.
Uh-huh.
And they like are mad at me about it, mm-hmm. but they actually got it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was amazing for me. Okay, some of the other ones were not as smart and were intended. And then when I say things like this, then I think some other people just roll up their sleeve as a way of thinking, okay, well, I'm going to try to like get a curveball around that one. And, you know, I mean, there's some that have been personal insults.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little harder to take as a younger person, you know, saying things like, you know, oh, I remember one that was really wild was Michael Kimmelman mentioned me in Balthus's obituary. And
whoa.
It said that I was doing better. You know, I had more than Balthus on some level, like more like people took me more seriously or I was getting more than Balthus. And I was like, dude. Balthus was a count, and like, first of all, he's Balthus, you know, you're writing an obituary to him. I'm not sure I would get an obituary in the Times. And I was just like, that's laughable. Like, but then I would always go, but it's kind of cool that someone would think that, you know, in a way, like, I guess that's my rebound spirit. You know, it's just like, you know, I'd find a way to like kind of bounce back from it, you mm-hmm. know, somehow and sort of find a way to,
is it like fuel? Though? Are you someone who is able to kind of take these things and then
well,
use them to your advantage?
I probably have up to this point, but I'm actually less and less interested in that. I've actually sort of stopped reading reviews, mm-hmm. especially if I find out that they're not nice. But I also think like reading negative or positive reviews goes back to Jesse's thing, which is it's really not, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you can't base what you're doing. I gave all of my sense of myself away the minute I walked into the Yale School of Art. I was like, I'm a humble servant of the Lord of painting. Please take me.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. And do as you will. And then was not cared for very well and lost my way pretty roundly,
mm-hmm.
was rudderless for years, made shitty art that I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the hard times in New York and elsewhere, one thing that really struck me, and I think being a working class kid may have helped with this. I know plenty of working class kids that aren't tough or are not tough minded. So I really think like, you know, it starts to become a cartoon, like, oh, you're like, you know, like something from, you know, our gang or something, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, like scrappy, you know, actually somebody calls me scrappy. It's like one of my nicknames. But I was like, I did that early on. I let it be like, what do you think of me? You suck. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I suck.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You just can't. What is it? And by the way, what does it matter if you suck? Mm-hmm. Well, why do you have, why, and what does it even mean to be like told that you're good? You're good based on what? It's based on criteria that exist. And we're supposed to be breaking ground. We're supposed to be doing something mm-hmm. that is different than what is known. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to make them come. We're supposed to, Muhammad's supposed to come to the mountain. And the art is supposed to be the mountain. Right. And you have to make something. I mean, I think one of the biggest breakthroughs for me was after getting lost and being rudderless and, you know, like just spinning around and hating my work. And this is an old trotted out story, which is told again and again, was where mm-hmm. I stopped painting and considered making film. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh shit, I have to go back to school and deal with some more assholes. that didn't work out so well. Oh, look, well, look at this. Paint, look at the carousel tray. This is my husband's carousel tray. And I actually wrote Levenstein MPP. Uh-huh. Isn't that funny? Painting we're just sitting here. Was it digital when
so you
went?
So you had written it?
Yeah, but I was on the intake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I shouted out, is he single? And that was like a little bit spooky. But anyway, so that was an aside, you know, yeah. Just a random thing. You can take a snapshot of that if it helps the...
Yeah, I can put it on the wall.
Yeah, put it on like that Maffei's carousel tray happens to still be sitting around. But anyway, so we were talking about the giving away our sense of...
Well, you didn't want to go back to school and have to deal with a bunch of assholes.
Right. So one of the things I did was I just stopped painting. I was just like, okay, so just stop. Uh-huh. You know, you're painting, something wrong with you in painting. Mm-hmm. So just knock it off. Don't do it anymore. And I went into a couple of things I did was I went to the New York Public Library and just researched everything and anything I could and went to the stacks. And it was pretty awesome because it was one of the stacks. Actually, you would fill out, you couldn't roam the stacks, but it's like you'd fill out a form and you'd put it in a chute and it would shoot up. It's like the main branch. I spent months in the New York Public Library. Months.
What just were you researching?
Anything and everything.
Just
and it all has come back. I have Xeroxes of things because wow. It was like, they were like microfilm things mm-hmm. that I like Xeroxed. Mm-hmm. And they're all in those boxes. I mean, I just have to like still filter through them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember a lot of it. I just, you know, putting my hands on it is a little bit different. I would find one thing and then sit there and like read the book. And at the end of it, I would sort of come up with like a list of things that were mentioned in the book, then go and research from there. Mm-hmm. And just keep like going from bibliography to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. And maybe it was like an article in a newspaper. And I was just expanding. I hated what I was doing in my studio. And I guess what I was trying to say is that one thing that not having any support financially can really teach you in this city. And now I guess people are living further and further away. Now they're living in Juniata Park in Philadelphia. You know, New York City is, you live away from here, mm-hmm, right? So in order to not be paying all right. the stupid, yeah. right, to be, yeah, you just have to make an effort. But you'd be making some crazy effort living here. So right. it makes total sense. But at that time, I'm like, okay, it's so expensive. It's so hard. Why would I want to make something that I'm not like in love with? Mm-hmm. And so until I can figure that out, I'm just going to stop. Mm. And it wasn't the cost of making art materials. It was like the studio thing and all of that. So it was just also the depressing feeling of being in a studio, looking at something that I thought was trying to please some unpleasable person that existed in my head.
Right. Yeah.
So I just quit painting and for a year just did a lot of research. I went to a lot of film festivals and watched as much film, read as many books, and considered applying to schools. And I started psychotherapy twice a week with a therapist I'm still with, who I famously painted in the transference portrait of my shrink in her starch nightgown with my face and her hair. Always one to make fun of everybody. She was a student. It was $5 a session.
Right.
So I started with five and now we're up to more. And I've given her art to thank her for seeing me back because I was pretty angry and nasty back then. So, you know, she got the least amount of money when I was at my right. most vicious. But I was like direct, you know, I learned how to direct all, like a lot of that stuff into the work instead of just being just like acting out in the world. And, you know, feeling angry can be great fuel, not necessarily about writers or people who don't like me. You know, in the end, all of that feels like first world privilege. Mm-hmm. What really didn't feel like a privilege was making art that I didn't like and I didn't believe in. Mm-hmm. So what happened is I was going around, I was doing all this stuff, and then I was going around in Soho, which is the only place there was art at the time, if you can imagine. And I remember seeing some pretty amazing shows of artists that are now considered, you know, called 80s artists. Mm-hmm. Mike Kelly, Paul McCarthy, you know, Laurie Simmons, and, you know, all these artists, Sherry Levine, who is now a friend, and, you know, just these weird, like, things, like seeing art that did not look like my art. But I remember thinking there were bits and pieces of all this art that I was seeing that I felt like if this could just be a painting, most of the things I was looking at were sculptures and responding to were sculptures, actually. And I was like, Mike Kelly's Afghans with those dolls. I was like, you know, because his experience of, yes, his working class, you know, whatever, 10,000 love hours and what that means. And it's that those people in the playroom, like those two adults in the playroom humping animals with shit on them. I was just like, oh, my God, you can make art like that. And so and then I thought, well, how could that be a painting? And then, you know, the thought occurred to me, maybe it's not painting that's the problem. It's the way I approach painting that's the problem. I'm approaching painting like some sort of, you know, and this is where I, when your original question about the Yale thing and how Yale made me feel the scullery maid and not part of the party, mm-hmm. is that I think that, but I don't think they do it. I think right. that we do it to ourselves. We absorb it because yes. of some low self-esteem right. that just pervades a culture. Mm-hmm. And like, who the hell do you think you are? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that when I came home from Yale, my former friends would be like, don't get fancy on us. You know, like that kind of thing was more what kind of was reverberating. At any rate, I realized I was approaching painting. I like to call it with the pinky up, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, it's high art.
Right.
And I had eliminated everything that was authentic to my actual, you know, the leasenness of it, mm-hmm. which is, yes, to say, but you know, like I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a feminist artist. I mean, I just wanted to make art that was reflected me in all of my lack of glory and glory and whatever the hell way it fell out. I just wanted to see something that was an artwork that even when I was walking around looking at art, even when I was watching movies, even when I was researching, it was, you know, the expression, it's an old adage, which is the true old adage about Michelangelo saying that David was in the rock and mm-hmm. he just needed to get rid of the excess. Mm-hmm. I started to get the feeling that I was in the room with it, that I had brought all these things in the room mm-hmm. and I just needed to see it. Mm-hmm. Like, what does it look like? Mm-hmm. You know, like and that actually having gone to Yale, having done all this, learned all this crap about painting and mediums and linen. Do I really need to learn about f-stops now on top of all of that? Mm-hmm. What I thought was the message I didn't think was legitimate. I would have been able to put it in a film, but I thought, why don't you put that thing that you're not putting in painting mm-hmm. and let the fucking fur fly, mm-hmm. which is why because I also thought I had the freedom that people didn't like my work, didn't care about my work, you know, thought I was a loser. And I was like, well, I guess that's freedom. So when you, I mean, I guess here's the, you know, I guess this is probably, I'm sure you probably need to wrap this up at some point.
I'm really enjoying it.
We can do part two.
Yeah.
You can come back. We did the old days.
And, yeah.
But I think that to this idea of make something that you wish was being made, mm-hmm. that you feel like is somewhere around you. It's like magical thinking at its best. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish that something, it's like kind of like this, but it's not, I don't see it. And you know, when I once or twice went to Yale and did, you know, reviews there, whatever, I would go into the studios and I would say, how do you want it? Hard, medium, or soft? Because I'd give them a choice.
Right.
My heart was never, you know, intended to, you know, be a true molestation of their sense of themselves. But some people are really touchy, so you could say, I like it, and they'll still say you were hard on them because you didn't give them your art dealer's cell phone number and a blowjob. I mean, I swear, some of these students, if you don't blow them and give them your art dealer's phone number, they're like, she didn't like it. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is wrong with these people? The sense of privilege, that needs to stop.
Yeah.
I mean, really. But real life tends to knock that out of people anyway. Nothing wrong with wanting a blowjob from just about anybody, but, you know, I'm just saying that I felt like the response I would get is like, she didn't like it. And I was like, I actually said I did like it, you know. But back to my point, is like, so I would go in and I would say, how do you want it, hard or soft? And it was like always funny when some people would say like hard. And then I say, okay, well, here's the hard part. Here's what I'm going to say is, you know, one of the things that usually these kids have said earlier in the session is, I don't like anything I see out there. Like, it all sucks. Mm-hmm. That's, you hear that over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. I kind of agree, except I don't think that I suck. Right. And I think that every time I have a show, it doesn't suck. I mean, Lane Relier might think it sucks, or certain art critics may think it sucks, but I don't think it sucks. And mm-hmm. I don't think I'm putting out bullshit. And I'm like, I resent that implication. But most importantly, here's the really important question. And this is giving it to your heart. What are you doing to not make it suck? Because mm-hmm. from what I see here, you're not doing anything. You're basically copying what sucks. Mm-hmm. I see pages of art form, and not the good parts of art form, like, which are the ads, mm-hmm. by the way. But I'm just saying, you know, it's like, how in the world can we change what we're seeing unless we get frustrated mm-hmm. with ourselves? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to change it by being like, you know, like, don't be so complacent mm-hmm. and blame everybody else for making bad art. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, do something about it in your studio. Be extremely motivated to change that. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if you never have a show. If you think it's good and you know it's good mm-hmm. and you're fighting for your life to make it, mm-hmm. it will be someday recognized. Mm-hmm. It will.
Yeah. Well, just real quick, too, how did you get your work into that kind of place of being seen? You know, like, how have you been able to piece this together?
What was my trick to get a show?
Not a trick, just, you know.
Well, if you look at my resume, the first show I had was at a library in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I would usually just, you know, take an opportunity. And actually, it's funny, my assistant who's scanning all this shit for me, she said she found the comment book from the Fairlawn, New Jersey. We're going to put that on the website because it's hilarious. Because the comment book at a library meant that, like, anybody could write it with it. And it said, most of the time it said, yucky. I was like, true.
13-year-old like girls or something.
Yeah, but then there were like, and you could tell from the handwriting, some adults that said, like, these look like old masters badly in need of a cleaning. And like, so these are like my Yale paintings, my post-Yale paintings and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it was really like I would take opportunities that were offered to me and mm-hmm. try to put my best foot forward. Because mm-hmm. you always learn something, whether it has to do with like, how to deal with comment books, or I'm never going to allow another comment book. The comments are turned off of my website. we could have comments on, but we choose not to. Like, you know, these lessons are, you know, or like everything along the way. I have learned, the summation of what I have learned is, go where the love is. Mm. And if, unless, and also try to learn from your mistakes. And, you know, one thing my shrink has always said to me, which I think is great, is fail better tomorrow. Because it's just, it will always happen. But mm-hmm. you just at least can, it's another way, I guess another way of saying, try not to make the same mistake. Mm-hmm. Maybe you make the same mistake, but it's not quite as catastrophic. Mm-hmm. I have survived everything so far and truly have learned, but no one thing that I've learned has really been repeated, mm-hmm. you know, like after the time I didn't get paid, you know, and got into serious trouble because I had paid so much money to make the work and, you know, put out, you know, the presumption being
mm-hmm. something like crime. Yeah.
It didn't ever quite happen exactly that way again. Mm-hmm. But the minute something got near that, I took action. Mm. It hasn't happened in a long, 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 long time, thank God. I have worked with good, honest people. And also, I think people start to get a sense that you're nobody's fool once you stop being, you know, they I also think that people, a lot of people love working with young artists honestly and legitimately. I also think that there are people who like working with young artists because they can take advantage of them. Mm. And because they're suckers, mm-hmm. you know, and I feel my heart breaks. Mm-hmm. And if I had the time, I would have a 1-900 number and because I would charge you for the yeah. call. Where I would say, you know, Lisa's helpline, and then the young artist would call in and say, blah, 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 you know, won't return the work, you know, da, 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 and I'll, like, say, yep, you know.
That's what they're paying for? Is you just
like,
yep.
No, but it'd be, like, sort of, no, it'd be like, okay, and this is what you got to do, yeah, right. you know, act quickly, right. you know. But also, you know, as an artist, I mean, this is running a business. I mean, mm-hmm. the minute you make a dollar, the IRS considers you a business, right? Or a little more than a dollar above a loss for several years, you actually get, you know, you're a small business. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, when people get married and don't realize that's a business transaction, right. you know, like, oops, it's like all of this is stuff where you have to, like, you know, grow the hell up and start to, like, treat it like a business. Mm-hmm. I had to learn to talk about money. Mm-hmm. And I was not raised to talk about money. Mm-hmm. I was not, I had no idea how much. I graduated from Yale and I got that thing called the exit interview. And I was like, what? I owe money? What the hell is going on? I was not, even though I didn't have money, my mom and dad sort of just didn't make that my concern. Mm-hmm. They were like, you have to go to school, you have to go to school. But, you know, when I got out and I had a lot of bad experiences, one of the first things I promised myself is that I would always be honest with young artists if they ask my opinion on something. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you know, I'm not out and about a lot, but if someone, and you know, and also, I mean, I just can't take that on because I need to be, I'm in this big space by myself all the time because I need to be by myself. There's a degree to which I can't do what I do with anyone around, mm-hmm. mostly because I'll talk to them. It's I'm the problem. Like if this girl comes to help me here, I'm like, you know, so what'd you eat for lunch? Did you go to the gym? You know, I am like, you know, Miss Chatty Cathy. But so in order for me to do what I do, I need to begin the, you know, the palette is an empty room. But I would like to be honest with people about, you know, whether or not they're being abused or being treated badly. Because I know that when I had the experience when this kind of thing was happening to me, people would say these really, I think, ugly things to me, like, oh, well, you were just lucky to have a show. I was like, but that doesn't mean that they should steal from you. That is not correct. And I just because I couldn't do anything about it doesn't mean that I took it in. Like, oh, yeah. I mean, it would change the fiber of who I am if I had accepted the idea that was right. Oh, I'm so lucky to have a show. I don't need to get my money. Which was, by the way, like $500. Right. You know, it was like literally like, oh, well, I'm sorry, I had to pay the gas bill. I'm running a gallery, so blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, it's just not right. And it's not the deal. And yet it happens. And sometimes it happens like they're not necessarily good business people or, you know, just in terms of like criticism, you know, like I have friends who are younger artists who have gotten nasty reviews lately. And I call them up and, you know, maybe I don't want to like rub it in. So I just say, you know, how'd you feel about it? Mm-hmm. And then we talk about it. And they're like, thank you so much for calling. Because I just think it's like, I'm like, welcome to the club, which maybe makes them feel really bad. Well, I don't want to be in that club. But I think that, you know, one of the things about the press is I feel really blessed to be paid attention to. Mm. I feel blessed to have you want to sit here and talk to me. Mm-hmm. And if anybody wants to tune in and listen to it, I mean, cause I know what it's like to have a tree fall in the woods, which is me and my work and have no one there to hear it. Mm-hmm. And that is the worst of all. Mm-hmm. So we can't take this stuff for granted. Mm-hmm. And I don't take it for granted. And there was a movie years ago, which, well, actually, it was not that old. called Catfish. They've now made a stupid television series about it, which totally misses the point. But it was it's a kind of a documentary or like a pseudo-documentary about a film crew who they do documentaries. There's a bunch of guys, and they do documentaries. And then they start doing a documentary about themselves because one of the guys gets a painting in the mail and a lot of flattery. Like somebody says, oh, I saw your photograph. He photographed ballerinas. And he said, oh, I saw your photograph, or he did a documentary about ballerinas. I saw this documentary. I was very inspired by it. So I made, and she, this long story short, he fell in love with the aunt. This was supposed to be a little girl who was just like saying, you're so awesome. You're so amazing. And he was like, oh my God, look at this. I'm so awesome. I'm so amazing. And everybody is just out there dying to be given, like me with the check, waiting for the check in the mail never came, never showed up. And I get a letter that somebody died instead.
Right, yeah.
But he ends up doing like Facebook with this little girl. And then the little girl suddenly has an aunt. An aunt is super hot. And then he falls in love with the aunt. And they have like phone sex, the whole thing. This is documented. And it's like it's kind of a riveting documentary. But my point about all of this is he gets kind of caught up in the idea of someone kind of being into him. And so apparently now anyone who lies and fakes on the internet is called a catfish. Based on this documentary. Okay. I don't know if it was, but my interest in this documentary, that is all very interesting, but my interest is at the end of the documentary, the way the documentary got the name Catfish is that he finally meets the woman. Spoiler alert. he finally meets the woman and it's all obviously completely the opposite of everything he thought. It's insanely different than what he thought. It's so sad. And kind of awful. And he's sitting on the porch. He's feeling really hurt and confused by the fact he was like, what do I do with this person I fell in love with? And what do I do about myself that I fell in love with this old lady who's like kind of a troll and, you know, like literally a troll, not like an internet troll.
Okay.
I mean, she was also that, but like, you know, some like crazy old lady who he allowed himself to actually have phone sex with her. And, you know, you know, it's this crazy thing. And so he's sitting on the front porch of their home with the woman's husband. And the woman's husband says, well, she was like your catfish. And he says, and then he explains what he means. And he says, when they used to send carp, I think it was carp, from Russia in barrels to the U.S., they would get here and the flesh would be mushy by the time it got here because they would just sit still in the barrels. So they came up with this idea to drop a catfish, one catfish per barrel. Not a shark, mind you, but a catfish. And the catfish, apparently catfish nip a lot and eat, like I think they eat algae. Uh-huh. And so they were nipping. They were just nipping all the fishes.
Yeah.
So the fishes were constantly moving.
Okay.
It kept them moving. And so my understanding of that, what the movie was using that term catfish for, was that the catfish are those things that keep your flesh from going soft. And so, you know, to sort of wrap it back to this idea of getting lucky if things don't go well for you, or being able to bounce back from things, it's like, it's hard to imagine, but you do need your catfish. And I think that's probably what Jesse was saying to me in like 1986 when he said, it'll happen again, or they won't love you. And when they disappear, you know, and she disappeared and didn't love me. And it was like, that was one of my catfish.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and I guess she was saying like, does that inspire you or make you stronger or whatever? All of the above. But I am now, I think, coming to a point in my life where I am not wanting to embrace it as much, because it's sort of like, and it's part of the reason why I did the website, and part of the reason why I'm open to people like yourself and this young artist, Jarrett, who interviewed me and have gone and talked to the Bruce and been a little more open, because I also realized that, you know, I have been doing this for like 25 to 30 years, 25 years professionally. I've only ever focused on the negative because they're so loud.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I've decided to focus on the love and the more like that kid that came in here, the Rayon Richards, who came in here and said that he became an artist because I inspired him. Did we get, was that on
yeah.
tape or that before
no.
we took, yeah, when he came in to take my picture and said he became an artist when he was in high school from LaGuardia High School for Performing Arts because he saw my work in a show at the Biennial. And I just was like, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I just read all the negative reviews from the Biennial, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I've just decided to sort of tilt my, you know, my I don't sail, so I should really avoid sailing metaphors, but I just want to sort of take a different kind of wind into my sail that is, you know, a more mellow wind that is a more loving wind, because I think it's out there. I think that I have come to understand that there's a lot of young people that actually have found what I'm doing inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean all of them, but, you know, the ones that don't can turn the sound off and look away. You know, I'm not expecting to, if you inspire everyone, you're not inspiring anyone really, because
right.
it's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I've just decided that was part of the reason why I wanted to use my database and to build this and to share a lot of the insights into what I do and how I do it, without it being, because I think that I am probably something I have learned about myself, and it's taken me a long time to figure this out, is that I'm probably the most outgoing person who's also very private.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad combo,
mm-hmm.
but I can't do anything about it. So I think it's because I don't really have very good boundaries,
mm-hmm.
you know? so I have to kind of shut.
What kinds of things do you keep private? Because
apparently nothing. Well, you know, that's what I'm saying.
Clearly they're private.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Well, no, it's just that I mean physical, like relationships with people.
Oh, okay.
Because
mm-hmm.
I can share all of this because I'm not in constant contact with, let's say, you know, I'm not a teacher
mm-hmm.
in the world, but I want to use the work in a way that is just put it out there for the, you know, to do the books
mm-hmm.
and to share these interviews and to share the information source material as much as I can and state some of the states of the paintings are in there. I guess that's pretty much what it is. Is that having said all of that, I mean, you know, now I'm 50, I guess, what year is it? Yeah, 53. is it an odd year or an even year? So I'm 53 now, and it's not like I'm like when I still get negative reviews and I choose to not really read them, I let other people read them for me. They give me the gist of it, but I almost feel like reading it and ingesting it is almost like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know.
You're still going to do the thing you do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I am sensitive, and I need to protect the fact that they're like, well, I should not lose a night's sleep because there's someone like you who, you know, is waiting for the next painting, and I'll waste my time, you know, not doing that. So the point is that I am just trying to really take possession of another phase of my life, which is to sort of say, to take ownership of all that I've done. I mean, I look at that, I go, shit, you did a lot of work. You know, and I haven't done anything else but make art, really. And I mean, I have fun and have, you know, a lot of friends and go out and, you know, do normal stuff, but I don't really get distracted by other things in life. And that has been really something that I've had to like take back and notice when I look at, you know, all those entries. And that's like a lot, you know, when I look at the website now and the database, I can see all these stories that I've told you playing out, like which paintings I was making when that happened and what was I doing, except for the year I wasn't doing any paintings, but which was the first painting I made when I came back to painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what it is so people can look it up.
Yeah.
They can listen to this and look it up.
Right.
It's all there. It's called The Gifts. And it was like the painting that I made when I went back to my studio when I was so fucking sick of my work
mm-hmm.
prior to that. And then I just like flipped it over and made this painting. And I literally felt like for the first time I could breathe air, or, you know, like somebody had like injected, like I was like a zombie and somebody had injected me with like life force.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the best feeling, especially because it's so hard to make art. It's so hard to keep going. And you have to do it, have it be something that's a really fun thing for yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not always fun. I'm not saying I'm like, I'll laugh a minute here. Right. You know, I got to start a new painting and the beginning is always the part that I like the least. Mm-hmm. But the general thing is that I like to come here. And I really like doing this. And, you know, the other good thing about it is, like, that actually is Sarah Z, probably somebody you'll want to interview next, calling me. I've been trying to call her for days now. She finally called me back. I'm not answering. But she, you know, she's somebody that met me when I was having a show. And it's like, this is the beautiful thing about the art is, even as young artists, we're looking at each other's work and we're complete strangers. And we say, oh, I want to know this person. Mm-hmm. And now we're very close friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like just like your peers at Yale, you were strangers, you're brought together, now you feel like family. It goes on from there. Like, you know, Laurie Simmons was in my studio and brought Lena and Grace, mm-hmm. you know, and we know who they are now. Right. And as little kids, you know, it's like, and it's like this world mm-hmm. is a kind of a magical world. And it's just, we're all kind of living, kind of looking at each other's thing, and it's not dead. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not making money, it is a wonderful life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a, not that you need me to be proud of you, but I think it's really cool, I'll say it that way, that you have figured out a way to do it so that you can afford it. Mm-hmm. And not, you know, you don't look beaten down living in the ghetto, right. like out in East Williamsburg, you know. So that's enough about me.
Oh, that was so wonderful. Thank you so much. So you have a show up until mid-December at the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University, right?
Yes. And it's not that hard to get there. Mm-hmm. And
it's an incredible show. Everyone should go
you
see
did,
it.
You did. You went to the
I
press preview.
Enjoyed.
Yeah. Yes. And it is 25 years of work. It's not a retrospective, but it's a lot of paintings. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they'll ever look that good anywhere else.
They
That's a beautiful,
amazing.
Beautiful museum. And there's yeah. a bunch of other things at the museum mm-hmm. that are beautiful. It's just a cab ride from the train station. It's mm-hmm. pretty easy to get every, and Uber works there, which is helps you get around now. And then the show is going to St. Louis afterwards
oh,
at CAM.
Awesome.
And it'll be a slightly different group of work. The one I'm working on in my studio right now is being made for CAM because
oh, wow.
there's a painting, the hippies painting can't, the loan couldn't be extended.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then we're also in CAM, the painting that was in my show at Zwerner, the green diptych called Bonfire, mm-hmm. which I'm very proud to say the Metropolitan Museum bought.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that exciting?
Oh,
so exciting. And that will be in the show at CAM amazing. Again. So they'll have new things in it. But then eventually the Met will show that painting, mm-hmm. I guess, in the old Brower building.
Was it purchased recently? Or
it was purchased recently, and I'm sure that it's all done through a committee, but it was
right.
a thrill because I love the Met and
so right.
they're getting so, if your listeners have not tuned into what they are doing with the Artist Project.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The Artist Project.
Did you do one?
Yes.
Oh, great.
And the Artist Project I think is absolutely extraordinary and mm-hmm. so well produced mm-hmm. and it is a wonderful way to look at the collection. Just go on their website. Mm-hmm. There's also an iPhone app for it too, but it's, theartistproject.org, and it's now three seasons, and I think it's going to be a fourth season, a Vuillard painting,
oh,
a little Vuillard
yeah.
painting, yeah, uh-huh. and that's how I got onto the whole green thing, is like uh-huh. the Vuillard. It's a pretty special thing that they've done, and they have an incredible digital aspect to the museum. So like the Met is going, you know, the Met is so encyclopedic and goes so far back, mm-hmm. but they have this the chief digital officer is Sri Sriensen, and he's like moving them incredibly into this digital thing to be able to reach people who may not be able to travel to get to the museum, but mm-hmm. to be able to experience museum. And with digital photography being so incredible, like you can see things. I mean, my eyes don't work as
right.
well anymore, even with glasses, and you're not allowed to get that close to the art.
Mm-hmm.
But they do these close-ups of what the artists are talking about. And maybe some of the artists, I don't even care like about their work necessarily, or I don't like know them, or I would never heard of them. But like I became interested in them and their work through listening to these things.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stuff people picked was crazy. Like people were picking coins, people were picking
oh, wow.
things in the archives
right.
that I didn't even know about. I mean, I picked
right.
something that was hanging.
Right.
I was very lazy about it. I didn't think too hard about it. I was like, oh yeah, let's just talk about that one. But yeah, it's pretty intense, and it's, I don't know, I have this like amazing sense of where they're going. I've kind of like my fingers crossed for a very exciting new thing in New York with this new energy for contemporary. Mm-hmm. So, but I would definitely say that people who may not be able to get to New York City or the Rose, you know, all of these things can be like researched on the internet. And just basically, just to end it, my website was created to be very open. There's an incredible Zoom function, and I'm very generous because, you know, apparently people can download that. And I'm like, so what? And people are like, oh, they could download it and make a poster. I'm like, so? I should charge Works a dollar? Yeah. I should charge a dollar for every poster? But I love the idea that someone, like whether it's living in like some rural town, they might be a real outsider in their community for one reason or another. They feel bullied, or they feel just, you know, like the rest of us who were artists, you know, isolated. And they, if they have an internet connection, which at this point many people do, at least through the libraries, and they find something and they bump into the next thing and they do the old surf in the internet thing, they should happen to want to know more about what I do. I just really want it, that little girl who just, you know, managed to get an immigration status in London, you know, who was, you know, fleeing some god-awful misogynist country, who now wants to make paintings and just for the first time might be able to, you know, just the information is there. And I'm not saying, but it's like, that is what I put it there for, is just for, you know, it's not like a go, it's not going to come and get you, you know, we're not going to put flyers in the mail. But like I told the guys that it was a team, the half of the team that was dealing with my archives were all female. And it's funny, the digital end of doing the website were all guys. And so I called the girls and the guys, but I was saying, you know, we just want this to be sort of like that Relaine Relier review. It's like, it's the stink bomb, you know? And it's going off. and I hope, you know, people, you know, it's like it, and just, you know, want it to be there for people who need it. Mm-hmm. And, so basically just about, and the other thing about it is that it's completely not editorialized. Gallery websites will always editorialize. They'll like leave out the bad stuff and because it's their job to make you look good. Uh-huh. But I just wanted this to be, you know, something where, you know, if you were curious about what are all these shitty Process. Reviews that she's talking about, you know, they could figure out how to dig. I don't have them separated into bad and good, but, that's, you know, the summation of that. That was my other commercial.
Right. Well, we'll put a link up on the site for sure so people can go check this out.
Well, thank you. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.